with SBS Radio.
My guest is Ben Atwood, Professor of History at Monash University and author of numerous books, including previous works include Rights of Aborigines, Telling the Truth About Aboriginal History and Empire and the Making of Native Title, Sovereignty, Property and Indigenous People. He's also the co-editor of Telling Stories, Indigenous History and Memory in Australia and New Zealand and Protection and Empire, A Global History. His latest book is a comprehensive biography of William Cooper, a biography that was described by Senator Pat Dodson as a fine tribute to an influential and canny campaigner whose struggle for justice has gone unrecognized for too long. Professor Atwood, why was William Cooper not properly acknowledged in our history?
I think it's the case that so many important Aboriginal figures have been lost sight of in Australia. William Cooper is merely one of those. For so long in this country's history, Aboriginal people, as you know, have been rendered marginal in the society, the culture, the politics. So there's nothing unusual, so to speak, in the fact that Cooper, until relatively recently, in the last 15 years, been a figure that very few white Australians, at any rate, have known. Obviously, he's well remembered by his own family and his people, the Yorta Yorta people, and by a small number of academic historians. But until about 15 years ago, his name wasn't really known in the broader world, in Australia, let alone anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, I remember myself first learning about him about two or three years ago, when a monument was erected in his hometown and it made news. But before that, we only heard his name on January 26, because we know the history of the day of mourning. And the rest of his life, very few people knew about it. Can you tell us about William Cooper's early life?
Cooper was born, as far as we know, about 1860. And I say as far as we know because while by that time in the Australian colonies, people were starting to be required to register the births of children, the births of most Aboriginal children were not registered. And so we can't be absolutely sure of when Cooper was born. As far as Aboriginal people were concerned in those days, as you would know, and this, I guess, continues to be true for many Aboriginal people, that the place in which they were born was much more important than the time they were born. And so many people of Cooper's generation or that of his parents' generation did not record the dates of their birth. But I think what happened for Cooper, there was a certain point in his life where it became either necessary or desirable to be able to say, well, this was my birth date. And I have some discussion in the book about why he might have, in my view, chosen the date that he did, that it seems to bear some relationship to the fight against slavery. And in that regard, it's probably interesting to note that at one point, Cooper and some of his other siblings actually bore the name of Wilberforce, in other words, the famous British anti-slavery campaigner. But then they either took the name of Cooper, surname of Cooper, or reverted to the surname of Cooper. Anyway, so Cooper was born, as I said, around about 1860 in his own country, in the country of the Yorta Yorta people, on the Murray River, probably in the context of a fishing enterprise that some white men established on the river and which Aboriginal people became drawn into because the river was a major source of their food supply and they had the kind of skills that these white fellows wanted. Then, as quite a young boy, he was taken by a leading pastoralist and politician by the name of O'Shaughnessy to Melbourne. He spent a few years living in Melbourne, then returned to his own country and started to acquire the skills of a pastoral worker, which sort of stood him in good stead for really the rest of his life. Then in 1874, he's drawn, if only momentarily, to a Christian mission that was in the process of being established by Daniel and Janet Matthews, again in the Yorta Yorta country. For various reasons, he was drawn to these missionaries, but at this time, the mission, which was called Maloga Mission, an Aboriginal name, was really focused on young children rather than youth like Cooper, let alone older Yorta Yorta people. So he continues to work on local properties, and it's only in the early 1880s that he's drawn to Maloga and decides to, in a sense, throw his lot in with other Yorta Yorta people at the mission. Following that, he really moves on and off Maloga, continuing to work on pastoral runs, but not only in the local area, but further afield. Takes him to many of the other Australian colonies at the time. Up until 1933, in that period of his life, where he suffers a terrible loss, his first wife and one of his two young children die as a result of an epidemic. He remarries, has several children by his second marriage. Then there are growing troubles on the Kamaragunja Reserve, Kamaragunja Reserve having replaced or taken the place, so to speak, of Maloga in the mid to late 1880s. And conditions on Kamaragunja, well, it's really political conditions. It becomes increasingly autocratic, and those like Cooper either choose or are forced to leave the mission, and he starts living at Barma on the Murray River. And then in 1933, so by this time, of course, he had been born early 1860s, by this time he's in his 70s. I mean, rather remarkably, he decides he's going to leave his own country and go to Melbourne, in order to be able to make or lead a campaign for, if you like, the rights of his people. And so shortly after he arrives in Melbourne in 1933, he draws up this petition to the British King, for which he's best known. And then throughout the rest of the 1930s, he dies in 1941, he forms an organisation, the Australian Aborigines League, and he and the League, as well as fighting for the main cause at the heart of his petition, which is representation in the Federal Parliament for Aboriginal people, he takes up many other issues on behalf of his people.
Well, a very, very active man. I've seen he's very known for so many petitions to government, and petitions were actually also claims for political rights and human rights and so on. But there's also a lot of industrial relations work, and like the Kamaragunga Walk Off is not just a right for Aboriginal people, it's also a right for fair work conditions, and so many aspects to his struggle.
That's right. I mean, I should have said before, when I was discussing the period of his life between roughly the 1880s and the 1930s, that yes, he's very much, with his work on pastoral runs, he's very much the trade unionist. He belongs to the Shearers' Union, he belongs to the Australian Workers' Union. You know, he is taking up the cause of working men, not only Aboriginal men, but other working men. And so he's quite heavily involved in trade unions. He subscribes to a trade union newspaper, the Australian Worker. So that's very much part of his work. And so later, some of the connections, political connections he makes in Melbourne, are with the labour movement. But also, it's important to note that he converts to Christianity, and he's a man of very strong Christian beliefs, as part of the influence of Daniel and Janet Matthews, but also Thomas James, who was a Sri Lankan man who came to Australia in the 1880s and soon joined Maloga and then later Kamaragunja. He was also a Christian, and he had a profound influence on Cooper. In fact, Thomas James marries one of Cooper's sisters, so they, they're family, they're kin. One of Thomas James's son, his oldest son, Shadrach James, is also one of the important figures in the Australian Aborigines League, the organisation that Cooper forms.
Yeah. Going back to his early life, what kind of education did he get to become such a towering figure, gaining so much knowledge in industrial rights, in race relations and all that? Where did he go to school was his influence?
Well, he actually had very little formal education. It seems that he starts to learn how to read and write before he joins the Matthews at Maloga, or before he goes there. At Maloga, it's a very short period of time in which he has a formal education. It seems to me that he acquires, the ability to read. He could read very well, so he's literate in that sense. But because he only had a short period of time of formal education, he learnt some of the rudiments of writing. But then I think his skills, by his own admission, got rather rusty. And so we can see that, in 1933, when he has this petition to the British King drawn up, and we can compare the letters that we know are written in his own hand with other letters that are in his name but written by other people, obviously with his with his approval. When we compare, as I said, the letters written in his hand and the letters written in others' hand, we can see that, and he said this himself, that he was really struggling to write. I mean, we know that he was an eloquent speaker, and as I said, he read widely. But when it came to writing the numerous letters that were sent in his name, he did work with others. I mean, Shadrach James is one of them. But then more especially, there was a white fellow by the name of Arthur Bordeaux, who was a fellow Christian and a fellow trade unionist. And they, in a sense, teamed up, and Bordeaux assumed the role of working closely with Cooper and penning most of the letters that then went in Cooper's name after about the middle of 1934.
Yeah, and all these petitions. He also, not only we mentioned that he was fighting for workers' rights and so on, and race rights, he went as far as even making some representation for Jewish people who are being persecuted by the Nazis, something no other Australian did.
Yes, in December 1938, and this is following the events in Germany and Austria and other places known as Kristallnacht. This was the attack of Nazi German government on Jewish people and property, an event that's now very well known in world history. In December 1938, Cooper and the Australian Aborigines League decide to draw up a petition protesting against the Nazi persecution of Jews, and they go to the German consulate in Melbourne and try and deliver this petition. This is an event that's become very well known in the last 15 years, but I have to say that I'm of the view that while now this is the way in which many people know Cooper, academic historians like myself believe this is a relatively insignificant event in Cooper's political work. Alongside of, I reached that conclusion because, well, in the book itself, it runs to about, as you know, it runs to about 200 pages. I only devote two or three pages to discussing this petition to the German government protesting against the persecution of Jews. And alongside this book, in the process of compiling a website, which, apart from anything else, will include something like 250 historical documents. Now, of those 250 historical documents, only one or two concern the petition. And I think that gives you some sense that it's really Cooper's other work, which we've both been talking about, which was really much more important and much more significant. And it's for that other work that I think Cooper should be best remembered for.
Yeah, like the Maloga petition, his challenges to authority, the Kamaraganja walk-off, which is actually a date that everyone should be remembering every year. And also, we are in the context of an epidemic. There was an epidemic you mentioned where he lost some members of his family, an epidemic of typhoid at the time.
Yes, I mean, what's interesting, I mean, as you might know, I first wrote about Cooper over 20 years ago, and I had some sense when I first wrote about him that his political work was profoundly influenced not surprisingly, by his experience and the experience of those around him, the Yorta Yorta people. But for this book, I had the opportunity to do much more research on his early life, and that convinced me even more than I had been previously of the degree to which his protest, his political work, grew out of the historical experience of his people. That one thing that enables his work is this association with Christian missionaries. It gives them, I think, a kind of, if you like, political language in which to protest against their conditions. But most importantly, it's the conditions that Aboriginal people experience, their dispossession from their land, their displacement from it, their deprivation, the discrimination they suffered. And I think part of what is interesting and important about Cooper is that even though he's born of so-called mixed descent, in other words, his mother is Aboriginal, but his biological father was white, he very much, and those around him in his organisation, they very much contest what was really a dominant white racial view at the time, that so-called half-caste were not really Aboriginal. And he regarded this, he resented this deeply, and he repeatedly explained to government ministers and journalists and others that he and other Aboriginal people of so-called mixed descent identified themselves as Aboriginal, that they were proud to identify themselves as Aboriginal, and they completely dismissed this kind of racial categorisation. There's a very strong thread in his work. I mean, it's also the case, you mentioned the Day of Mourning earlier, and I think we'd agree that the Day of Mourning on the 26th of January 1938, sesquicentenary of white settlement or the white invasion, that's an event that's now well known. What's less well known, I think, or if it's known at all, is that, in my view, this is very much Cooper's idea of a day of mourning. I think it's clear that he was the first to suggest it, and that he believed that this was very important to try and bring to the attention of white Australians what Aboriginal people had suffered as a result of the colonisation of their country. And it's not only at that moment when he suggests the day of mourning, but running through, I think, his political work is the sense of the importance of, you know, of recognising that Aboriginal people, you know, were the owners of this country, that if anybody had rights to land, even though he was only ever asking or seeking small pieces of land, if anybody had a right to land, it was Aboriginal people, because they were the first peoples. And that's, you know, a very strong thread in his work, just as in the petition to the King in 1933, that the central demand, if you like, of the petition is for representation in Parliament. And so these days, I guess, we would regard this as, if you like, prescient, that here he is seeking a voice in Parliament, not a voice to Parliament, but a voice in Parliament. It's a modest request, because he's only seeking one Aboriginal representative in the federal parliament, although at other points he makes it clear that he thinks Aboriginal people should be represented at all levels of government, state government, the councils that manage Aboriginal reserves. He believed very strongly that they should be represented. I think it's also clear that in the petition, well, he makes this clear, that he believed that when the British began to colonise this country, that they had given an undertaking to protect the interests of Aboriginal people. So this wasn't, you know, by no means a formal treaty, but he nonetheless believed that some promise had been given to Aboriginal people to protect them. And he believed that, you know, the word protection should mean something, you know, very important. He believed that an undertaking had been given, and that that undertaking had been repeatedly breached. And so what he's trying to do in his political work was to bring to the attention of white, or what we now call settler Australians, the fact that Aboriginal people were the first peoples, that they had been given an undertaking to be, for their interests to be properly protected, and that they had not been. So there's a really, if you like, in my view, a strong historical thread in Cooper's work. He's, you know, I mean, we're now more common, I suppose, more familiar with that idea, because it's what's marked so much of Aboriginal political work since the 1970s. But what I'm trying to do in the book is draw attention to the fact that, you know, there's really a long thread in this kind of argument. Aboriginal people are the first peoples. they should be recognised as such, that they should have some rights on the basis of being the first people. This runs right through Fupa's work.
And one of the quotes that you mentioned in the book is, what was, coming back to the day of mourning, what is a memorial for the coming of the whites is a memorial of death for us. Now, what were his later years and his final days and maybe years and months in, of his life?
Apart from anything else, there were times, not surprisingly, where he became very dispirited. And that here he is, he's writing to government, especially but not only the federal government. He's getting some acknowledgement, formal acknowledgement of the letters that he sends. Having drawn up the petition to the king in 1933, he holds it back for some time, but then becomes very frustrated in 1937 after a major conference of administrators of Aboriginal affairs, which he has high hopes of, and they're dashed. And he presents the petition to the federal government. From his point of view, nothing seems to happen. He's not aware, and he's never told that behind the scenes, so to speak, the prime minister of the day, Joseph Lyons, seems to be actually somewhat sympathetic to the petition and directs officials to look into it. He doesn't know anything about that. And so there's a one point where he says, I mean, clearly drawing on his knowledge of the Bible, he says something to the effect, we ask for bread, but we only get a stone in return. So there's this really strong sense that he's fighting very hard on behalf of his people, and that he's getting nowhere. I mean, and this was true. I mean, Aboriginal people at this time were so denigrated that not everybody in government, but the majority in government, did not think that those like Cooper should be taken seriously, that they might and did take notice of white campaigners on behalf of Aboriginal people, but this, by and large, is not true of the campaigners like Cooper. So there's moments where I think he's very depressed, but to his credit, he continues on. But by 1938, or at least 1939, by that time, he's almost 80 years old. His health is clearly starting to fail. He seems to have a coronary problem. And if memory serves me right, in August 1940, he sends to Robert Menzies, this is the Prime Minister of the day, he sends what is his last political letter to him. And strikingly, at the end of this letter, he asks, and he just continues to ask, what has happened to my petition to the king? What are you doing? Anyway, shortly after that, his wife decide that they need to leave Melbourne and return to his own country. And that's what they do. And he passes away a few months after he returns. And he's buried at Cummeragunga. And people, Aboriginal and white, come from all around. He's a deeply respected figure. That's also the case, and perhaps I should have mentioned this earlier, that when he passes away, the local newspaper, or one of the local newspapers, which was in the habit of running quizzes, so to speak, in its pages, formulated a question, something to the effect of, what was the name of a well-known Aboriginal man who passed away recently, who had considerable success as an athlete in his younger days? So this was also one of the ways in which he was known. Even more so, one of his sons, Lynch Cooper, became a very famous athlete in the 1920s and 1930s, winning some of the major sprint events of the day. But he was following in the footsteps of his father. His father was a rather more officially a hurdler, and so this was just one of the many talents, if you like, that he had. Several years before he died, he recruited, so to speak, Doug Nicholls, also a Yorta Yorta man, as many of your listeners probably know, a famous Australian rules footballer in the 1930s. He seeks Doug Nicholls out, Cooper does, and he really nurtures him politically. Nicholls becomes his protege. And so after Cooper passes away, or a few years after he passes away, Nicholls and another Yorta Yorta man, Bill Onus, and his brother, Erokinas. They revived the Australian Aborigines League, and they very much have Cooper's work in mind that has a profound influence on them. One of Cooper's, it seems, favourite phrases was the phrase "thinking black," and Nichols takes up this phrase. So lying behind Cooper's idea, or his call for Aboriginal representation in Parliament, was this belief that, for the most part, only Aboriginal people could think black. In other words, that only they could see the world from the perspective of Aboriginal people. And he believed that this was so because of the particular historical experience they had. And he believed, as so many, of course, Aboriginal people believe today, that what's required in Australia politically today is that Aboriginal perspectives are heard and taken notice of. And, of course, this lies behind this call for a voice to Parliament. But this is what Cooper was saying, I believe, in his petition, that Aboriginal people, they thought black, they thought in a particular way, and that Whitefellas couldn't think like this because they had such a very different experience. Or at one point, Cooper puts this in terms of the Aboriginal people are the sufferers and the white people are the conquerors. So he's really saying, well, how could white people really understand Aboriginal people given that fact? And so he, as I said, he's calling for Aboriginal representation so that their distinct perspectives can become part of the Australian polity.
Yeah, he laid the foundations for today's struggle because most of the words and themes he actually championed are what we are seeing in today's younger generations of campaigners for Aboriginal rights. And
so it's a wonderful legacy.
Yeah, Professor Bain Attwood, author of William Cooper, An Aboriginal Life Story, the most comprehensive biography and important tribute to the work and life of Uncle William Cooper, an extraordinary Aboriginal activist. Professor Attwood, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us today about this very important book.
Thank you, Robert. Thank you for the opportunity. I've really enjoyed talking with you.
Want to hear more stories like this? Listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.